Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into something really, really foundational for anyone designing anything, really. It's this idea that Phil Warnath burns so well. Design isn't what we draw, it's how we think when nobody's watching.
Exactly. It's about what's going on under the hood, you know?
Yeah.
The mental frameworks, the ways of thinking that help you cut through the confusion, especially in that that messy middle part of design everyone talks about.
Right, the messy middle. So our mission today is basically to push past all the hype, you know, the endless stream of new tools, new buzzwords that pop up constantly.
Yeah, they can be distracting.
Yeah.
We want to focus on what actually helps you make better decisions. How do you pick methods that like genuinely reduce risk? How do you build meaning for people, not just interfaces that work?
And ship with confidence, ultimately. That's the goal, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And our main guide here is Phil Warnath's piece, My Favorite UX Heuristics and Methods, a practical guide. What I love about it and what we'll dig into is that it feels less like a textbook and more like, well, like a field guide. Stories from the trenches.
That's a great way to put it. It's about the lenses he actually uses. It's not just theory. It's about how to see clearly, how to think strategically about your choices.
So the big idea, the thing we'll keep circling back to is this. Heuristics, methods. They're not just checklists you tick off.
No, definitely not. Think of them more like different lenses in your toolkit.
Hmm.
Ways to look at a problem from different angles. The real skill is knowing which lens to pick when, how to combine them, right?
And validating early, catching those wrong turns before you go too far down the road.
Exactly. And figuring out what's actually going to make a difference for this product, for these users right now. It's very contextual.
It's a mindset shift, really. Phil says something like, these aren't rules, they're questions that keep you honest.
I love that quote. It captures it perfectly.
Yeah. So we're going to explore how that kind of questioning helps you avoid getting tripped up by your own tools, you know, making sure they're helping, not hindering. So yeah, let's unpack this. Where do we start?
Well, you have to start with the basics,
mm-hmm.
the foundation, usability baselines.
Okay. So like the non-negotiables for a good experience.
Pretty much. Think of them as your first aid kit for interfaces. The quick checks you can run to see if something is clear, consistent, usable, often before you even get it in front of actual users.
Gotcha. Early diagnostics.
Precisely. And one really powerful technique here is the cognitive walkthrough. It's kind of specific, but incredibly insightful.
Cognitive walkthrough. Okay, tell me more. How does it work?
So its main goal is to figure out if new users, people seeing it for the first time, can easily figure out how to do things. And the key thing is, you don't use actual end users for this.
Oh, interesting. So who does it then?
You bring in a mix of people from the team, maybe other designers, product owners, engineers, anyone who hasn't worked directly on that specific part of the interface and doesn't have prior experience with it. They act as proxies for new users.
Okay, so you get fresh eyes, but internal ones. That makes sense. It feels like a way to find those obvious to us, but not to anyone else's kinds of problems.
You nailed it. That's exactly what it's good for, because you're not just watching someone use it. You're stopping at every single step of a task.
Every step.
Yeah. You define a core task, say, adding an item to a shopping cart. Then the group walks through each action needed. And at each point, they stop and ask themselves a set of four specific questions.
Four questions. Okay. What are they? Are they complex?
Not at all. They're deceptively simple, but really probe the design. They come from research back in 2002, but are still super relevant. The first one is, will the user instinctively try to reach the desired outcome?
Instinctively.
Right.
So does the design match what they'd expect, their mental model?
Exactly. Are we making assumptions about what they already know? Does the path forward feel natural based on their past experiences online? Or are we forcing them to learn our weird, unique way of doing things? If they have to stop and think about where to go first, that's a potential red flag.
Okay, makes sense. Avoid making them think unnecessarily. What's the second question?
Is the correct action obvious to the user? Will they notice it?
Ah, so this is about discoverability. Is the button hidden? Is the interface too cluttered?
Precisely. You know, sometimes in the quest for minimalist design, crucial actions get hidden or styled in a way that they just blend into the background. This question forces you to check. Is the next thing they need to do visually apparent? Can they actually see it easily?
Right. Function over pure form sometimes. Okay, number three.
When the user takes the action, will they associate it with the outcome that actually occurs?
So does the system's reaction match their expectation? If I click save, does it feel like it's saved?
Exactly. It's about the feedback loop.
Yeah.
If you hover over an icon, does the tooltip make sense? If you click a button, does the response confirm what you thought would happen? Any mismatch here creates confusion, maybe even distrust. It needs to feel predictable.
Predictability, yeah. Critical. And the last one, number four.
If the user takes the correct action, can they see that progress is occurring toward the goal?
Ah, feedback again, but more about progress, like loading spinners or confirmation messages.
Yes, exactly that. If a task takes time, even a second or two, users need reassurance that the system is working. A progress bar, a simple processing message, even a subtle animation. And then, once it's done, is it clear what happened? Is it clear what to do next? This question checks if that feedback loop is closed effectively.
Those four questions seem incredibly focused on that first-time user experience, on learnability.
They really are. It's a fantastic way to find those early stumbling blocks.
So how does this cognitive walkthrough compare to, say, a heuristic evaluation? That's another term people hear a lot.
Good question. They're often mentioned together but serve different purposes. The cognitive walkthrough, like we said, is task-specific, step-by-step, and focused on learnability for new users using those four questions.
Okay.
A heuristic evaluation is broader. You have typically one or more UX experts evaluating the entire interface against a set of established usability principles or heuristics.
Like Nielsen's heuristics.
Exactly. Jacob Nielsen's 10 usability heuristics are the most famous example. The evaluators apply these general guidelines across the whole design, looking for violations. And they might be familiar with the product already, unlike in a walkthrough.
So walkthrough for first-time task success, heuristic eval for overall usability best practice.
That's a great summary. They complement each other really well, both find different kinds of problems.
And Nielsen's heuristics, they've been around forever, but people still talk about them. Why are they considered, as Phil puts it, still gold for quick wins?
Because they just work. They capture fundamental truths about human-computer interaction that haven't really changed. They consistently flag those basic usability issues that teams, especially teams who've been working on a product for a long time, can become totally blind to.
Like the curse of knowledge.
Precisely. And they provide a common language, a shared checklist, for the whole team, designers, PMs, engineers, to talk about usability without needing, you know, a full lab study every single time. They're efficient.
Okay, let's quickly refresh on those 10. Maybe add a bit more flavor. Number one, visibility of system status.
Right. This is about keeping users informed. It's more than just progress bars. It's about managing uncertainty. When you submit something online, that little spinner isn't just decoration. It's reassurance. It tells you, I'm working on it. Don't click again. It builds trust, even when things are slow.
Yeah, that lack of feedback is anxiety-inducing. Okay, number two, match between the system and the real world.
Use language users understand. Use conventions they already know. The trash can icon, pinching to zoom. These things work because they mirror physical world actions or established digital conventions. Don't invent new icons or jargon if a familiar one exists. It just creates friction.
Makes sense. Leverage existing knowledge. Number three, user control and freedom. The undo button's best friend.
Huh, exactly. People make mistakes. They change their minds. You need clear emergency exits. Undo, redo, cancel, a clear back button. It makes users feel safe to explore because they know they can easily backtrack. Without it, they feel trapped and frustrated.
Empowering, not trapping. Got it. Number four, consistency and standards, internal and external, right?
Yes, both are key. Internal consistency means things work the same way within your product. The save button always looks and acts the same. External consistency means following platform and industry conventions. Users expect search icons to look like magnifying glasses, for example. Don't make them relearn basic patterns.
Reduces cognitive load. Number five, error prevention. Better than just good error messages.
Way better. The best error message is no error message. Design defensively. Use constraints, good defaults, confirmation dialogues for destructive actions, helpful hints before they submit the form. Guide them away from likely errors.
Proactive design. I like that. Number six, recognition rather than recall. Help my poor memory.
Exactly. Don't make users remember information from one part of the interface to another. Make options, actions, and objects visible. Think recently viewed items, autocomplete suggestions, clear labels instead of obscure icons.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing options is easier than recalling them from memory.
Especially for infrequent users. Okay, seven, flexibility and efficiency of use. Catering to novices and experts.
Yes. Allow users to tailor frequent actions. Accelerators like keyboard shortcuts for experts shouldn't confuse novices who can still use the menus. Personalization, customization, these things allow the interface to speed up for experienced users without adding complexity for newcomers.
Smart. Number eight, aesthetic and minimalist design. Not just about looking pretty.
Definitely not. It's about clarity and focus. Every extra piece of information or visual element competes for attention and increases cognitive load. Good aesthetic design helps communicate structure, guides the eye, and removes distractions. It's functional beauty. Less is often more, truly.
Focus. Okay, number 9, help users recognize, diagnose, and recover from errors when prevention fails.
The recovery needs to be graceful. Error messages should be in plain language, precisely indicate the problem, and constructively suggest a solution. Invalid input is useless. Please enter your postcode in a 5-digit format is helpful. Turn frustration into a learning moment.
Empowering again. And finally, number 10, help and documentation, the safety net.
Right. If the system is complex, good help is essential. It should be easy to search, focused on tasks, and contextually available. Think tooltips, FAQs, tutorials, chatbots perhaps. Provide help when and where users need it without making them hunt for it.
That's a solid foundation. Heuristics, cognitive walkthroughs, great for looking at the interface itself. But what about understanding the user's world, their context?
Now you're talking about stepping outside the lab or the office. For that, you need different lenses. And a great framework for structuring that kind of observation is AEIOU.
AEIOU, like the vowels.
Exactly. It's an acronym, a framework specifically for ethnographic observation for contextual inquiry. It stands for activities, environments, interactions, objects, and users.
Okay. Activities, environments, interactions, objects, users. How does it help?
It structures your curiosity when you're out in the field. Instead of just randomly jotting down notes, you use these categories as buckets. What activities are people doing? What's their physical and social environment like? What interactions are happening between people with technology? What objects are they using? Tools, devices, paperwork? And who are the users themselves? Their roles, goals, attitudes.
So it's like a structured checklist for observation, ensures you capture the different facets of the situation.
Precisely. It helps you notice things you might otherwise miss. You can even make a worksheet based on it for your field notes. It forces a more holistic look at the user's context beyond just how they use your specific product.
That sounds incredibly useful for getting that rich qualitative data.
It really is. It helps turn messy observations into structured insights.
Now, beyond these frameworks and methods, there are a couple of core usability factors that are just critical.
Yeah.
You mentioned accessibility and retainability. Let's talk accessibility first. It often gets treated like a compliance thing, a box to tick.
Which is such a missed opportunity. Accessibility is about ensuring everyone, including people with disabilities, can perceive, understand, navigate, and interact with your product on an equal footing. Yes, there are legal and ethical reasons, but honestly, it's just good design and good business.
How is it good business?
Because accessible design often benefits everyone. Think about captions on videos, essential for people with hearing impairments, right? But also super useful for anyone watching in a noisy place or with the sound off. Or high contrast modes, great for people with low vision, but also helpful if you're using your phone in bright sunlight. It expands your potential audience and makes the experience better for many users.
That's a great point. The curb cut effect, right?
Exactly. And the standard everyone refers to is WCAG, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines.
WCAG. And they have those four core principles, POUR.
Yep, POUR. Perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust.
Let's unpack those quickly. Perceivable.
Can users perceive the information being presented? This means things like text alternatives, alt text, for images, captions, and transcripts for audio video. Information can't be invisible to any of their senses.
No.
Can users actually operate the interface? This covers keyboard accessibility. Can you do everything without a mouse? Enough time to read and use content, not designing content that could cause seizures like flashing lights. The interface components must be navigable.
And understandable.
Is the information and the operation of the user interface understandable? Use clear language, make things behave in predictable ways, provide help with errors. Users shouldn't have to guess what things mean or how they work.
And robust.
Can the content be interpreted reliably by a wide variety of user agents, including assistive technologies? This is mostly about using standard code, like valid HTML, CSS.
Yeah.
So it works now and is more likely to work with future technologies. Don't rely on non-standard plugins, for example.
And we're designing for various impairments, right? Visual, auditory.
Visual, auditory, motor, and cognitive are the main categories. WC provides different levels of conformance. AAA. Most organizations aim for level AA as a good, achievable target that covers a lot of ground.
Okay, that's accessibility. What about retainability? That sounds important, but maybe less talked about.
It's hugely important and often overlooked. Retainability is simply, how easily can users remember how to use your product effectively when they return to it after a period of not using it.
Ah, because most people don't use most products every single day.
Exactly. Think about tax software, or booking a holiday, or some internal corporate tool you use once a quarter. If you have to completely relearn it every time, that's a terrible experience. Good retainability means the design is intuitive, consistent, and relies on recognition over recall so users can pick it back up quickly.
Makes total sense. And you had a great real-world example of accessibility in practice, the Koios Learning Platform in Ghana.
Yes. Koios was a learning platform we built for about 300 students there. And accessibility wasn't just a WCAG checklist. It was driven by the reality of their context. Mobile first wasn't a buzzword. It was essential because phones were often their primary or only internet device.
Right.
And we added a custom dark mode. Not just because dark mode was trendy, but because many students studied at night, maybe after work, possibly with unreliable electricity. Dark mode used less battery and was easier on the eyes in low light. It showed how accessibility, when truly user-centered, is about enabling people in their actual circumstances.
That's powerful. It's not abstract. It's deeply practical.
Absolutely.
So we've covered usability, accessibility, the foundations. But good design isn't just functional, is it? It needs to connect emotionally. That brings us to meaning and engagement.
Right. This is where we move beyond just can they use it to do they want to use it? Does it matter to them? It's about designing for human connection, purpose, resonance. Especially vital in areas like civic tech or mobility, where motivation isn't just about efficiency.
So let's break down some of these engagement factors. What makes an experience sticky? First up, narrative.
Humans are wired for stories. Does your product make the user feel like they're part of a story? Maybe it's their own story of progress or a collective story. Fitness apps often do this well, framing workouts as part of a larger journey or challenge. It taps into a fundamental way we make sense of the world.
Turning tasks into quests. I like it. What about activation?
Does the product actively encourage involvement? Does it give incentives, stimulate discovery, offer meaningful choices? Passive consumption gets boring fast. Activation is about designing for interaction, nudging users to explore and participate, not just sit back.
Keeping them involved and adaptivity.
This is about the product feeling aware. Does it adapt to the user, their context, their situation? Personalization is key here. A maps app that reroutes for traffic. A music app that suggests songs based on your mood. When a product adapts, it feels more intelligent and tailored, creating a stronger connection.
It feels like it gets you. Immersion sounds intense.
It can be. Immersion is about capturing the user's full attention, triggering senses, creating focus. Think gaming or VR. But even simpler products can create moments of immersion with satisfying feedback, focused interfaces, or engaging visuals, leading to that flow state where time disappears.
Flow state, yeah. Aesthetics, we touched on this, but it's an engagement factor too.
Definitely. Attractive things are perceived as more usable. It's called the aesthetic usability effect. A beautiful interface evokes positive emotions, makes people more tolerant of minor flaws, and simply makes the experience more enjoyable. It's not just decoration. It affects perception and engagement.
Interesting. Authenticity. How does that play in?
Users have a good radar for fakeness. Does the product feel genuine, original? Does its message align with its actions? Does it fit with user values? Authenticity builds trust. If the brand voice or the experience feels contrived or manipulative, users will disengage.
Trust is key. And finally, flow again, but as an engagement factor.
Yes. Distinct from immersion, flow here is about the smoothness of the path. Does the product create a seamless sequence of actions? Can users move effortlessly towards their goal without hitting roadblocks or confusing steps? A well-designed flow state makes interaction feel effortless and satisfying, keeping users engaged.
These engagement factors are powerful, but then there are even deeper meaning factors, tapping into fundamental human needs. Let's touch on those. Popularity.
This isn't just about being famous. It's about feeling liked, respected, influential within the context of the product. Social media likes are an obvious example. Does the product provide social validation or recognition?
Makes sense. Sense of purpose.
Does using the product make you feel important, helpful, like you're contributing something meaningful? Think open source contribution, citizen science, or even just a well-designed to-do list that makes you feel accomplished. Purpose drives deep engagement.
Relatedness, belongingness, this feels huge.
It's fundamental. Does the product foster connection with others? A sense of community. Regular contact with people who care. Online forums, team collaboration tools, shared interest groups. They all tap into this deep need to belong.
Absolutely. Security.
Feeling safe, in control, knowing the system is predictable and your data is protected. Without this baseline security, users can't relax and truly engage. It's foundational trust.
Autonomy, independence.
Feeling like your actions are self-chosen, not forced. Does the product give you agency, control over your experience? Flexible workflows, customization, choosing your own path. Autonomy fosters ownership.
Competence, effectiveness.
The feeling of mastery. Does the product make you feel capable, effective? Good feedback, clear progress, tools that make hard tasks easy. Achieving competence is incredibly satisfying.
Stimulation, keeping things interesting.
Yes. Enjoyment, pleasure, novelty. Does the product offer moments of delight, fun, or new sensations? Micro interactions, engaging content, visual appeal. Stimulation fights boredom.
And the big one, self-actualization.
The top of Maslow's hierarchy, right? Does the product help you become who you want to be? Does it align with your values, help you learn, create, contribute to causes you care about? Products that connect at this level become deeply meaningful.
Wow. Thinking about design through these lenses, engagement and meaning really elevates it beyond just pixels and code. It highlights the power of storytelling in UX.
Absolutely. Storytelling isn't just marketing fluff. It's about weaving narrative into the design itself to make it more relatable, memorable, and engaging. It humanizes the journey.
Why does it work so well?
Stories grab attention better than facts. They're easier to remember. They build emotional connections and trust. They provide context that helps guide users. Good storytelling can dramatically change how a product is perceived and valued.
And you mentioned four pillars for effective storytelling in UX: authenticity, empathy, consistency, impact.
Right. Authenticity. The story must feel true to the brand and user experience. Empathy. It has to start from a deep understanding of the user's world, their struggles and dreams. Consistency. The narrative needs to hold together across all touch points. Impact. The story should inspire action or leave a lasting emotional impression.
So how do we actually do it? How do you integrate storytelling?
It starts with research, understanding the user's before state, their problem. Then define the narrative arc. The beginning problem, middle journey with the product as guide solution, and end resolution, success. Use visuals, images, video, animation. Craft microcopy that's conversational and guides the story. Add interactivity where appropriate to make the user participant.
You had another great example here. Together, the commuting app. It wasn't just about traffic, was it?
Not at all. That project perfectly illustrates uncovering deeper meaning. We use the five whys technique. Why avoid commuting? Traffic. Why hate traffic? Stressful. Lonely. Why lonely? Miss office social connection after the pandemic. Boom.
So the real pain point wasn't traffic jams, but isolation.
Exactly. By understanding that, the project reframed itself. It wasn't just about efficient ride sharing. It was about fostering belongingness and turning solo commutes into opportunities for connection. That deeper narrative, based on a real human need uncovered through methods like the five whys, made the product much more compelling.
That's a fantastic shift in perspective. Okay, let's switch gears slightly. We've talked principles, frameworks. Now let's get into the specific methods that keep paying rent. The reliable tools in the toolbox.
Right. Phil Warneth emphasizes this. While every project is unique, some methods just consistently deliver high-value insights. They help you make decisions grounded in evidence and empathy.
Let's start with discovery and exploration methods. These are for when you're still figuring out the problem space, right? Uncovering the unknowns.
Precisely. And one method that's amazing for getting raw emotional feedback is the love letter and breakup letter exercise.
Love and breakup letters to a product.
Yeah. You ask participants to write a letter to a product they love as if it's a relationship, and one to a product they dislike or stopped using. It taps into emotions and frustrations in a way standard interviews often don't. You get the real story, the hidden pain points, the things they truly value. Great for early discovery.
That sounds fun, actually, and revealing. We also mention AEIU for observation that fits here, too.
Absolutely. AEIOU. Activities, environments, interactions, objects, users, is crucial for structuring your observations during discovery fieldwork, like contextual inquiry.
Contextual inquiry being watching people in their natural habitat.
Exactly. Going to their office, their home, wherever they actually use the product or perform the task you're interested in. You see their real environment, their workarounds, the tools they actually use, the interruptions they face. It reveals so much that people wouldn't think to tell you in an interview.
Because often they don't even realize they're doing workarounds.
Precisely. It's just how things are done. Contextual inquiry surfaces those implicit behaviors.
What other discovery methods are worth mentioning?
Card sorting is classic for understanding mental models and informing information architecture. How do people naturally group concepts? Diary studies are great for capturing behavior and feelings over time, getting longitudinal insights, and cultural probes giving users toolkits like cameras or journals to document their own lives can yield really rich creative insights into their world.
And the together example fits here again, using AEIOU during discovery.
Yes, using AEIOU during observations of commuting really helps systematically capture the nuances, the activities people did while commuting alone, the different environments, the interactions, or lack thereof, the objects, phones, podcasts, and the users' expressed feelings. It built that rich picture that led to the insight about belongingness.
Okay, so after discovery, you need to test your ideas. Let's talk evaluation and testing methods.
Right. Validating assumptions, measuring effectiveness. Usability testing is the cornerstone here, watching real users try to accomplish tasks with your prototype or product. There's no substitute for direct observation.
Always humbling, usually insightful.
Always. Then there's desirability testing. This helps you gauge the emotional response to different visual designs. You show users design alternatives and ask them to pick adjectives like fresh, trustworthy, dated, confusing, that best describe each one. It helps guide the aesthetic direction.
Beyond just, I like it, getting at the feeling.
Exactly. And for more quantitative validation, A-B testing is powerful.
Yeah.
You show different versions, A and B, to different user groups and measure which performs better on key metrics like conversion rate or task completion. It's scientific comparison.
Data-driven decisions.
Yep. And don't forget the ones we already discussed. Heuristic evaluation for expert review against principles and cognitive walkthrough for checking first-time user learnability. They're essential evaluation tools too.
Got it. Now, sometimes you need to generate new ideas, not just test existing ones, creative and generative methods.
Yeah, for breaking out of ruts or exploring completely new territory, brainwriting, 6-3-5, is a favorite of mine.
How does that work?
It's a structured, silent brainstorming technique. You typically have 6 people. Each writes down 3 ideas in 5 minutes. Then they pass their paper to the person next to them, who reads the previous ideas and adds 3 more, building on them or adding new ones. You repeat this cycle.
Silent. So it avoids the loudest person dominating.
Exactly. It levels the playing field, ensures everyone contributes, and encourages building on each other's thoughts rather than just competing. Really effective. Another good one is SCAMPER.
SCAMPER? Another acronym.
Yep. It stands for Substitute, Combine, Adapt, Modify, Put to Another Use, Eliminate, Reverse. It's a checklist of prompts to systematically spark new ideas by transforming an existing product or concept. You ask questions like, what can we substitute? How can we combine this with something else?
A structured way to think outside the box.
Precisely. And for service design or complex systems, business origami is fascinating.
Business origami? Like folding paper?
Kind of. You use simple physical representations, paper cutouts, objects to represent people, artifacts, systems, and environments involved in a service. Then you physically move them around on a table to map out the interactions, the value exchange, the touch points. It makes abstract service concepts tangible and collaborative.
Visualizing the invisible connections. Cool. Any others?
Collage can be great for tapping into subconscious feelings and metaphors through visual expression. And sensorial brainstorm encourages thinking about all 5 senses, not just sight, which can unlock different kinds of creative ideas.
Okay, so you've done discovery, testing, generation. You've got heaps of data, notes, ideas. Now what? Analysis and synthesis methods. Making sense of it all.
This is where the magic often happens, finding the patterns. Affinity diagramming is fundamental.
Sticky notes on a wall.
Pretty much. You take all your individual observations, quotes, ideas, each on a separate note, and start grouping them based on natural relationships or themes. It's bottom up. You let the patterns emerge from the data itself rather than forcing predefined categories. It's amazing for seeing the bigger picture in qualitative data.
Finding the signal in the noise. What about prioritizing ideas?
The evaluation box, sometimes called the COCD box, is great for that. It's a simple 2x2 matrix plotting ideas based on originality versus feasibility. Helps the team quickly sort ideas into do now, explore later, maybe not, avoiding endless debate.
Quick visual prioritization. Nice.
There's also the KJ technique, which often follows affinity diagramming. It's a more structured, often silent way to prioritize themes or items using voting or ranking, again, reducing groupthink and focusing on collective judgment. And laddering.
Laddering, like climbing.
Sort of. You use probing why questions to dig deeper into user motivations. Why is that feature important to you? And why is that important? You keep asking why to move up the ladder from concrete product attributes to more abstract benefits and ultimately to core human values or needs. It connects product details to deep motivations.
Connecting the what to the why. Powerful. You had another example here, Smooth Ride and citizen feedback.
Yes, Smooth Ride was a platform for citizens to report infrastructure issues. We used affinity diagramming to cluster thousands of reports. Initially, it looked like just a list of problems, potholes, broken lights. But as we clustered, themes emerged. People weren't just reporting, they were sharing experiences, adjusting solutions, talking about neighborhood identity.
So the synthesis revealed it was about more than just complaints.
Exactly. The affinity diagram showed the underlying desire wasn't just fix this pothole, but help us make our community better. It transformed the project's understanding from a simple ticketing system to a platform for collaborative ideation and civic engagement. Synthesis reframed the entire problem.
That's a brilliant example of analysis driving strategy. Okay, sometimes standard methods aren't enough. We need specialized and scrappy approaches, especially for weird problems or new tech.
Right. When you're dealing with something novel, like AI concepts or behaviors that are hard to observe, where you just have very limited resources, you need some clever tricks up your sleeve.
Let's talk Wizard of Oz testing. Sounds magical.
It feels a bit like magic. The idea is you simulate a system's backend response manually. The user interacts with an interface, thinking it's fully functional, maybe powered by complex AI, but behind the curtain, a human, the wizard, is actually pulling the levers, generating the responses in real time.
Why do that? Why fake it?
Because it lets you test user reactions to advanced concepts before you build the expensive tech. Users interact naturally because they think it's real. You learn heaps about their expectations, mental models, and desired interactions for things like AI, voice interfaces, complex recommendations, without writing a line of complex code.
So you use this for SmoothRide's AI recommendations?
We did. We wanted to see how citizens would react to AI suggesting infrastructure improvements. Instead of building the AI, we used QuantUX for Wizard of Oz setup. The researcher acted as the AI, feeding suggestions into the interface based on simple rules. We learned immediately that users wanted inspiration and collaboration, not just automated reports. It shaped the product direction massively, very early on.
Super clever. What about speed dating concepts?
Just like it sounds, you rapidly show users a series of different concepts or rough prototypes, one after another, getting quick feedback on each. Like speed dating for ideas, it's great for quickly gauging initial appeal, understanding preferences, and narrowing down options when you have lots of possibilities.
Fast iteration, an experience sampling method, ESM.
This is about capturing in-the-moment data. Instead of asking people later, how did you feel when X happened? Here, you use prompts, like phone notifications, to ask them short questions or get them to log feelings or activities as they happen throughout their day. It avoids memory bias and gives you really rich contextual snapshots of real-life experience.
Getting data from the wild. And crowdsourcing, using the masses.
Yeah, leveraging platforms like Mechanical Turk or specialized user panels to get feedback or complete micro-tasks at scale. Need 100 people to categorize images, need quick feedback on 5 different button designs from a diverse group, crowdsourcing can provide that breadth quickly and often quite affordably.
Now, you mentioned a really detailed case study that ties a lot of this specialized evaluation together, the one on mobile augmented reality, MAR, prototypes.
Yes, the study is fascinating because it tackled a core problem. How do you evaluate user expectations and needs for a technology that barely exists yet that isn't fully functional? Especially something as potentially disruptive as MAR.
A real challenge. How do they approach it?
Their key innovation was methodological triangulation. They didn't rely on just one method. They used 3 distinct UX evaluation tools to get a richer, more robust picture. SUXES, MACARD, and Attractive.
Okay, break those down. SUXES.
SAXES is a questionnaire that measures subjective user experience. Crucially, comparing pre-use expectations with post-use experience on things like usefulness, ease of use, pleasantness. For the MR prototypes, it helped them see if the concepts generally lived up to users' initial hopes.
EmoCard. Sounds emotional.
It is. It's a nonverbal tool using cartoon faces representing different emotions, like calm, excited, pleasant, unpleasant. Users just point to the face that best represents their immediate feeling after interacting with the prototype. It's great for capturing those gut reactions, bypassing verbal filters.
Instant emotional read and attractive.
Attractive is a questionnaire that measures both pragmatic qualities like usability, efficiency, does it do the job well, and hedonic qualities like stimulation, identity, is it exciting, does it reflect well on me? It uses pairs of opposite adjectives, e.g. simple, complicated, stylish, unstylish, to get a nuanced view of both the functional and emotional appeal.
So they used these three methods to evaluate four MAR concepts.
Exactly. They had a street tagging app, a navigation info app, a really interesting language barrier app that overlaid icons on foreign text, and a playful virtual pet app, covering different potential uses.
And what did they find? Which concepts worked?
The MR language barrier app was the clear winner. Users immediately saw its true utility value. It got strong, positive emotional responses, emocard, and high pragmatic scores. Attractive. It solved a real relatable problem. The playfulness app, however, was largely rejected. Users didn't see the point. It lacked perceived utility, even if it was novel.
Utility trumped novelty in that case. What did this teach them overall about designing for new tech like MAR?
Several key things. Users initially prioritized pragmatic needs, usefulness, ease of use. Get that wrong, and you're dead in the water. But hedonic qualities, the emotional appeal, the stimulation become more important for deeper engagement and adoption. They also found users value concreteness, realizability, it feels achievable, personalization, and intuitiveness.
And the big takeaway from the study methodology.
That triangulation works. Using multiple methods gave them much richer insights than any single one could have. And it validated that you can get meaningful data about user experience, even at the conceptual stage, by carefully evaluating expectations and reactions to prototypes.
Which brings us right back to Phil Warneth's starter pack idea and lenses, not checklists. These specialized methods are just more lenses for specific situations.
Exactly. It's about choosing the right lens or combination of lenses for the specific challenge you face.
Ooh.
Avoid overfitting the method. Don't just use the tool you know best. Use the tool that best fits the problem. See clearly, validate early, prioritize effectively. That's the mantra.
So as we wrap this up, let's just quickly recap that advice on how to pick methods. It's not about having a giant list, but a thinking process.
Right. First, start with the problem, always.
Yeah.
What's the biggest risk? What's the most critical unknown right now? Then mix and match. Combine methods to get different perspectives, qualitative and quantitative, attitudinal and behavioral.
And ask the questions the methods provide. Don't just go through the motions.
Crucial. Let the questions guide your analysis. Then look for patterns across your findings. Where do different methods point to the same issue? That's likely something important.
And finally, the tough one. Prioritize ruthlessly.
You can't fix everything. You can't explore every tangent. Based on your goals and the evidence, decide what truly matters now for these users and this product. Focus your efforts there.
This really reinforces that idea of escaping tool obsession. The fundamentals matter more.
So much more. Phil uses the carpenter's paradox, rely only on power tools. And you forget how to use a handsaw. Designers shouldn't be lost without Figma or their favorite research platform. The core skill is thinking, observing, empathizing, synthesizing. The tools just help execute.
Like the gardener reading the soil before buying the fancy irrigation system?
Exactly. Understand the fundamentals. Read the signals from your users and the context first. Tools amplify good judgment. They don't replace it. Trust the messy conversations, the whiteboard sketches, the field notes.
Because the map isn't the territory. Tools are maps, but the meaning is in the journey, the understanding you build.
Perfectly put. Don't get so obsessed with efficiently drawing the map that you forget where you're actually trying to go, which is solving a real human problem.
So the core thesis one last time. Heuristics and methods are lenses to see clearly, not checklists to worship. Mix them, validate early, prioritize what moves the needle for this product, these users, now.
And never lose sight of the ultimate metric Phil mentions. AI is great. The only metric that matters, did we solve the user's problem? That cuts through everything else, doesn't it?
It really does. A fantastic grounding thought to end on. If this deep dive resonated with you, definitely check out Phil Warnoth's work. He has a great cheat sheet on picking methods.
Yeah, and related posts like roles, lenses, and the sushi schnitzel problem or hashtag ducked up engineering that explore these practical, no-nonsense ideas further. Really valuable stuff for anyone building products.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep asking those honest questions.